So they start literally building log cabins at rallies. They serve cider, hard cider, in these giant barrels.
Awesome.
They would wear coonskin hats, and while they're talking about this, and they made up, you know, they made up the very famous campaign song "Tippecanoe and Tyler Too."
Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name is Kyle, the Cedric Popkin to Eric's Von Richthofen, and today we're talking all things not Tippecanoe, because we're not onto John Tyler yet. We actually still have more William Henry Harrison stuff.
We have so much more William Henry Harrison.
Two more episodes. Oh my God.
I did not do hours and hours and hours of research on somebody to only do one episode. No. So let's set the stage. So we talked about the election of 1840 last time. So today we're going to do a dive into what that election actually looked like. Not because we didn't cover it well enough in that last episode. I know we only gave it like a minute. Honestly, it's an interesting but not that interesting episode. What's interesting are the policies that occurred that allowed William Henry Harrison to win. We're going to give you a play-by-play of his lengthy time in office. I think we're going to be good there.
Nice.
But I was like, I really, nobody ever talks about the election of 1840 because it gets so overshadowed, but it's a huge election. It's the first election to elect a Whig.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time we see the failure of the Jacksonian Democrats, which I think is crazy because 12 years ago, Jackson wins in this huge landslide, and he wins in such a large landslide. It kills the Democratic Republican Party. It kills the party that Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and John Quincy Adams belonged to. It kills the presidency of the majority of the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, this is crazy. This wave's overtaken America. Oh my God, Jacksonian democracy. Blah, blah, blah. Dead. Yeah, immediately.
It caused like the worst financial panic in the history of the United States and some other like bad things that happened during that time too.
Yeah, so what happens that you're like, I had the most popular political party in the United States. I had a political party so popular, it destroyed all other political parties. And now this random party that has only really been around, it kind of was around before. It was more National Republicans than it was Whigs, but the term Whig
didn't get really organized until like this election is what it sounds like.
It really only got organized because, you know, Little King Andrew is what, with all the executive orders and functions that Andrew Jackson was doing, decided to form a Whig party or an anti-royalist party, where the Whigs come from, the term Whigs come from, to overthrow him. And they do it immediately. The meeting, they form a party. They're like, oh, cool. All right. We formed a party. And like, oh, we lost the election of 1836 because everybody's like, let's give this Van Buren guy a try. And they immediately defeat Van Buren. They're like, oh, we tried that. Doesn't work. Apparently, it's a cult of personality. And wow, this immediately
feels kind of a shame because they actually kind of liked his presidency after we got to the end of it. Like,
Van Buren?
Yeah, I kind of, well, maybe it's more his end of life, but to see the changes towards the end of that presidency.
Yeah. He made some good moves as president. Divorce bill. I'm a fan of the divorce bill.
Yeah.
The divorce bill that the Whigs voted against, then it finally got passed, then they voted against it again, and then they were like, that was a good idea. We'll put that back in. That will define banking in America for 90 years. So what made a party that kind of just formed able to take down the massive momentum of those Jacksonian party? And it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah, always the economy.
It's what decides every election.
Did the bond market exist during this time?
It was a bond market, yeah. Remember we talked about the Brits were like, we're going to be like 6%. I like that short you did with that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think it was like
there's a whole arc of those actually. I need to make them all into a playlist to go together.
Yeah, just Eric ranting about interest rates. But yeah, it's it's really cool. So what defined it? Well, it's the economy, right? And the reason it's the economy is, you know, you're in a recession. You're in the worst recession people ever saw, and you saw it come back to life. You saw some awesome maneuvering by Nicholas Biddle. You saw some of these U.S. bank that actually was really just a chartered bank in Pennsylvania, and you see some of these good policies. But you keep seeing the Jacksonian snuff out anytime something starts working or any sort of fiscal
discipline. Biddle guy?
Discipline.
Forget that. We're not doing that.
We're not going to do what this professional banker is telling us to do. And Van Buren is based, so it's just kind of funny. Despite this being completely caused by Jackson, Van Buren saddled with it. Like, people like don't want to blame Jackson for this, which is crazy to me.
That's insane.
So the bank war really hit, and funny because we just mentioned it, really hits this apex with the Atlantic credit cycle. That's what we're talking about with the Brits. And at this point, there's no way to really get out of it outside of just waiting. We talked about the episode on the panic of 1837.
Getting money movement, right? You need the flow.
You just have to wait for prices to collapse. Like you just have to wait for the return to become valuable enough that can only be done on the price basis, really, at this point.
Yeah.
So what the Whigs did is this is kind of a cool strategy to get Harrison elected. What they did is they kind of made it a binary choice. They framed the moment as a choice between the Depression under Van Buren. They were very careful. Remember, this is the election of 1840 is the first time the first time any political party really had a campaign, really mobilized teams in every electorate campaigning for their candidate.
Oh, wow.
Actively going out there.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, what we see now. It was really the first time that happened. You know, it is funny. We go from, 12 years prior, a president literally running, not running, like John Quincy Adams not actively campaigning to
right.
mobilize professional, vote-getters. So they showed it as, okay, you can continue under the Depression under Van Buren, or you can have a fresh start under a war hero with a record of
a better
order.
Record.
Yeah. Right.
So, because you sound like you're trying to say they were very careful not to blame Jackson when they saddled Van Buren with it.
Yeah, they didn't want to blame Jackson because they knew that could be a little bit of a sticking point. But they were like, do you want to vote for Van Buren or a fresh start under a war hero who promised order, credit stability, and internal improvements? And you could look at Harrison and say, man, he did all those things very clearly. And they did an excellent job of creating coalitions. And it is one of the few times by this point in American history, it's not the first time, but it's one of the few times we see actual coalition building.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of let's get a group of electorates together and convince them that they're all voting for their best interests, even though they all belong to either different guilds or different trades or anything like that. And we ended up, splitting across. You had the merchants in the Northeast, mm-hmm. and you had what we call the Upper South, that where Virginia area and stuff like that. And then the Western voters, so the Ohio, the Indiana voters, those guys, who were they wanted infrastructure, right? They just want a ton of infrastructure.
That makes sense.
The merchants obviously wanted the Atlantic credit cycle to stabilize so they could start selling stuff. But then a new group emerged, and it's a new group that will actually begin to decide elections for kind of the rest of American history. The urban artisans. And people are like, urban artisans?
What the hell? Yeah,
they decide elections? Yeah, dude, that's the middle class. That's the right. That's the dude who went to college, has a degree in accounting, and is working in the city. That was a modern day, that's pretty much a modern day artisan.
So we're basically seeing the middle class start to develop at this point in time.
Dude, 100% right. Huh. In this diverse coalition are each kind of sold. They never, it's not like they're changing William Henry Harrison into a different thing for different people. What they're saying is William Henry Harrison has this track record of a great general, right? He has this track record of a great administrator. He has a track record of a great legislator who supports fiscal stability, who supports infrastructure, who has shown to be an effective manager, both on the battlefield, but also in political offices. And they're saying, hey, merchants, we have a diplomat who went to Grand Columbia and understands a former senator. Like, oh, no, that works. I mean, he gets this. All right. Oh, he's also a very effective executive. He knows how to run stuff. And you're a merchant. You're like, I like executives. He knows how to run a business. I know that. And they go to the Upper South and they're like, hey, and you're like, well, I'm worried about slavery. And like, well, he owns slaves and he's from Virginia. In Virginia.
So they tailored the message to each group that they went to.
Yep. Which is how modern politics works.
Right.
So they went to the Western farmers. And he was like, hey, do you like that plot of land you have? Oh, how'd you get that? Oh, the Harrison Act of 1800. Yeah, that Harrison.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, he's running for, oh, wait, he was administrating our property too. Yeah. Do you like Detroit not being British? Oh yeah, he was the guy who won that battle too.
Oh yeah, that guy.
And then the artisans are like, oh, he's just super fiscally. His whole thing is fiscal stability. And I'm an artisan who suddenly is out of work, and I'm out of work largely because the government decided to be unstable,
right?
Because of the instability of the government. And they're like, I like that. And I mean, Van Buren had no chance, dude. He had no chance going against
John Tyler.
Why do you feel bad for John Tyler? John Tyler's loving this.
No, because you got all this, like, William Henry Harrison did this. He did this. He did all this. Like, wouldn't you like him to run? Oh, yeah, we also have John Tyler, too.
At least they used his name.
Right, yeah.
To make a new one. Tyler, too.
Right.
So it ends up, it is kind of funny, because it works. It works really, really, really well.
He said there's pretty much a demolishing election. Like he won the popular vote. He won the electorate. He, like, sounded like a landslide, would you say?
Yeah, kind of. It was the Democrats were in shambles, though. Yeah. Like you kind of feel bad for Van Buren right now. So the Whigs are meeting in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And then the Democrats are meeting in Baltimore at the time in May of 1840, and they renominate Van Buren. They're like, okay, you know, he's the protege of Jackson. You know, maybe we'll give him another chance. He has the stink of the Panic of 1837 on him, but he's trying to make these improvements, but the Whigs are jamming him up. But they declined to renominate his vice president, Dick Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And
the double dick.
The double dick. and so they ran. This is horrible. They actually left the spot open for the state electors to sort it out.
Oh, wow. So
they didn't even do it as part of the convention.
Was this kind of like a throwaway? Are they just like, yeah, we'll get it next cycle kind of thing?
I don't know, man. Like, part of me says it feels like it.
Kind of feel, especially got the, like you said, the stink of the Panic of 1837. It's kind of like a lost cause. Like, you know what? We'll just, let the next guy hand. Because, I mean, it's still going, right? The effects of this thing felt for 7 years. Like, maybe you don't want another guy in there. Like, I don't want the stink of this on me. Like, let somebody else handle this.
Yeah, so exactly. So as the Democrats are leaving, they start seeing kind of the Whig mobilization. Like, oh, crap. So they start – normally elections where campaigning was obviously in person, stuff like that, but it was done in the newspapers. This is the first time you see this – like I mentioned earlier, you see this mobilization of people trying to gather electorates.
Mm-hmm.
So they start making, as they're leaving, they're like, oh, what's going to be our messaging, all right? So how are we going to disparage Harrison? And what the Democrats do is they basically start depicting him as this is going to be a referendum on character and consistency. And Harrison's this, he likes hard cider, and he has a log cabin, and the phrase was he'd be content with a pension, a log cabin, and a hard cider. And Harrison's like, yeah, who wouldn't be? What are you talking about? But they phrased Van Buren as a steady, constitutional, and prudent president. It's like, yes, you may have been during your presidency, but I tend to remember you being a vice president under somebody who I would describe as none of those things. none of those things.
Right.
And so that was horrible. So of course the Whigs are like, they love it. They turn this around. They start calling him, like, you know, they start referencing like, oh, you know, in material about Harrison, you know, loving hard cider and all this stuff. And they just lean into it.
Sounds like they just were good spin doctors. Like, they just knew how to put the good spin on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, so as they're campaigning again, you know, this is their first real political campaigning. Yeah,
he's got professional campaigners. I wonder.
Yeah, so they start literally building log cabins at rallies. They serve cider, hard cider, in these giant barrels.
Awesome.
They would wear coonskin hats, and while they're talking about this, and they made up, they made up the very famous campaign song "Tippecanoe and Tyler Too." It was awesome. It was just like political marketing at its extreme. And it just destroyed the freaking Martin Van Buren's campaign. He comes off as like elitist, who's, you know, the complete opposite of won the campaign for Jackson. He comes off as this like elite. He really gets framed kind of similar to what Jackson did to John Quincy Adams. He gets framed as this elitist and stuff like that.
He's got that weird speech or accent because he speaks Dutch as a first language.
Yeah, which is probably not super helpful when you're right. running. Where Harrison...
He likes to drink a cider.
Cider. Are we allowed to do Dutch accents? I feel like that's not okay.
That's probably... Was that a good one? I can't tell.
It was pretty good. I liked it. But I think kind of one of like my favorite parts during this is Van Buren's like... Van Buren's just like... Oh, sorry, not Van Buren. Harrison's... See, I mentioned this before about Harrison just being a very likable guy, being very, you know, there's a lot of indications that he was just charismatic. Like, well, he has this, like, wicked cheerful. He's older at this time for people. I remember he's born in 1773, so he's 67 at this point, which is, that's old for that time period. Dude, he's, like, cheerful. He's joking around, and he has this, like, constant cheerfulness. That's a term that I saw a couple times, where he's just, like, happy to be there. He talks to everybody. He goes to the rallies, and people are like... This guy's awesome. He talks about his like, he's joking around in his log cabins that are set up at rallies. He's serving hard cider and stuff to people. Like he's like, I'm gonna vote for this guy. But it wasn't just that he was this likable guy. It was also like he's an incredibly effective administrator. He ran a very large territory. It'd be the largest state if it was a state at the time. He's a maneuver warfare genius. He freed Detroit. Like. Oh, and then he served as a diplomat. He was a senator. You're like, oh, this guy. Oh, and then this legislation that he passed when he was in Congress and advocated for was on these like super liberalizations of land and allowing people to do what they want to do. And you're sitting there and be like, you're in the middle of a panic. Like everybody's miserable and unemployment. Right. There's some places that have 90% unemployment in port towns.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And you have a guy, you know, some people put the estimates at about 25% national unemployment. And you have a guy coming around who's like, has a prudent plan of how to get out of the recession. It's not built on some hullabaloo. It's about good infrastructure investment. It's about stabilizing the loan-to-credit cycle. And he has a resume to show it. Everything the guy's touched, he's been successful at. And not through, like, pure iron will, and you're going to follow me directly, but no, by being a good leader and understanding situations.
Understanding logistics, and right.
Yeah, so it's, like, really appealing. And that's why I found funny. We never talk about We never talk about the election of 1840 in school. And it gets wiped off. Oh, the guy died after a month. I don't think people realize how much it invigorated the country of being like, oh, this is really cool.
Not even just for that. Like, if you want to talk about a reason to teach it, I mean, if you're talking about the first time there was actually, like, a political campaign with people who, like, studied that is what it sounds like. Like, that's kind of a huge turning point, too. And you can kind of see the...
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to see the effects of that, like how much they just basically demolished this other campaign that's being run by amateurs.
Yeah. And what's even cool is that, so again, you got to think bad economy. People are struggling. This is kind of like the first presidential election that really used a lot of trains. So he's going from town to town. They're setting up these things. They're setting up these things called quick print presses where they ought to put out newspapers. They have one called the Log Cabin, which is just like effectively just – it's like a campaign flyer, but they called it a campaign newspaper. They started organizing things called Tippecanoe Clubs, which were like little campaign hubs. But they were open to everybody, and they would schedule these mass meetings, and these crowds were drawing tens of thousands of people. In the 1840s. And he would have parades, and you'd see floats and banners and marching bands. And it created this sense of, like, happiness. I mean, it's a sense of momentum. And, again, I think because we don't study him that much, because we ignore him because of these, you know, his 31 days in office or whatever it is, that we don't talk about all his whole, the 40 years that made up beforehand.
And right.
How much that meant to the American people, because they're sitting there going like, oh my God, we actually have somebody here who knows what they're doing. Don't forget, a lot of these people like Jackson because he was a military leader. But now you talk about a military leader who's also an effective governor, effective at everything he did. And on top of it, he's this guy who just seems like to have a good time and has a good plan.
Again, how can you not feel bad for John Tyler?
Yeah, it is. The more I talk about this, the more I'm not realizing it stinks.
Yeah. This great person now, 4 weeks later, like, well, I guess that's my turn.
I don't know if this is true. So obviously in Parks and Rec at the museum, they have the giant ball. So that's a real thing. They had a giant ball. Yeah. And they would use the phrase, keep the ball rolling. Mm. I don't know if that's where that phrase come from. There's like two sources that reference that, but they had horrible like citations. Like the, I don't think that's where it came from, but it is funny.
But that's John Tyler's motto.
Yeah, John.
Keep
John
the ball rolling.
But what's funny is, so the Democrats got together and were like, how do we challenge Harrison? How do we challenge him? So they started referring to him as Granny Harrison. you know, they were like, oh, look, no, he's tied to the old bank and he's tied to these tariffs. And, you know, Van Buren wanted an independent treasurer and, you know, he had honest finances and the recovery's already on the way, guys. Just hold on a little bit more.
Right.
And he got eviscerated. People were like, what are you talking about, dude? You were the vice president when Jackson manipulated all the banks. What are you talking? The tariffs are abomination. Yeah. You proposed that when you were in Congress.
That was
you.
And
Van Buren's, he has no ammo for it. And so then the term of Granny Harrison's not working that well because Harrison's so leaned into the, like, all he wants is a pension, a hard cider, and a cabin. And they're building cabins. It's hard to call somebody a grant. Be like, oh, look at him. He's an old guy. And he's like, sitting in a rocking chair in a cabin that, like, his guys built, handing out drinks to people. Like, that's not – that you've lost that ammo. Yeah. But
like,
the worst
– everybody wants a log cabin and cider, and we're going to give one to everybody.
Yeah. And – the worst part about it is that Van Buren starts to, not, I shouldn't say Van Buren, this is more the Democratic like campaigners at the time. Some of the newspapers are trying to like poke, oh, he doesn't really have that much legislation experience. And of course, they're saying that against a mobilized campaign force. And that mobilized campaign force is like, oh, here's our litany, oh, of all these different farms and infrastructure bills and everything he's done. And look at him being the chief administrative officer and all these treaties and all this stuff. And it's like, why did you kick that fire, man? You were better off just not talking about it. But to lead up to the end of the election, something that the Whig leadership did that was very interesting. They stayed very vague on their platform. They were specifically non-specific is that year's phrase I saw that I liked a lot.
So the real first true politician then.
Yes. So the party had two. You had your regular Whigs, but then you also had a group like sometimes they're called like the National Men. And that's Clay Webster and a few other dudes and who were like in Congress, wielded a lot of power, obviously, one of those freaking Henry Clay. And they supported protective tariffs, a national bank, distribution of federal land revenues to states, and all these different infrastructure and internal improvement programs. So in Congress, they were campaigning around the promised change, recovery, and good times without enumerating instruments. In other words, without ways to fund them. And they kept this going. And Harrison himself was more focused on, I am going to lead the way I've led my entire life. I'm a war hero. I'm an honest administrator. He ran deeds in the registry, and there doesn't seem to be a lick of bad things anybody had said. Do you guys know how complicated running probate is? Not have somebody wanting to hate you? the Democrats, towards the end of the election, they try to clarify. I think honestly became too granular in their policy. Like, we want limited federal government. We want no bank state entanglements and a hard money fiscal regime through an independent treasurer. But nobody believed them. I mean, because you just have the Jackson on you.
The stink of Jackson.
Yeah. And it was a lopsided victory. He won comfortably both in the popular and in the electoral vote. He carried it. I mean, what's even more interesting, it's not just that he won electoral votes. A lot of times he was winning some states just by massive margins. Van Buren didn't stand a chance. I think it's largely because of Jackson. I think the Democrats at the time put themselves in a horrible situation.
Yeah. I mean, but they started by electing Andrew Jackson. That was probably a mistake.
I think they sold so heavily on Jackson that they were married to any decision Jackson made had to be the right decision.
Yep.
Even when it clearly wasn't. Yep. And I think Van Buren being a puppet at that point in his life for Jackson meant that even though Van Buren had good ideas, he couldn't maneuver away from it.
Right. You can see that he did somewhat once he got out of the presidency. So maybe that was actually the best thing that could have happened for him was losing that.
A second term of Van Buren I think would be really cool. Mm-hmm. I think that would be really interesting.
It would be interesting to see if he would have shaken off, you know, like the full shadow of Jackson from himself.
Yeah, I think he would have. I think he could have been an effective administrator. So the 31 days of William Henry Harrison's presidency, the only thing people know about him. So he was sworn in March 4th, 1841.
Okay.
And he would die April 4th, 1841.
so how much did he get done during those 31 days?
Kind of surprisingly a lot for 31 days, especially when you compare it to modern, what the first 100 days of modern presidencies look like. So he shows up. It's disgusting out. He delivers the longest inaugural address on record, 8,445 words. And he is gross outside, dude.
It's like a storm, too, right? Like
it's stormy. Yeah. It's a raw, it's one of those like raw early March days. I don't know. Like, if anybody here is anybody like lived in New England,
those are the
Kyle,
days
you were up here up, like in April in New England.
Yeah,
right?
I've heard that March or February is about the time when most Bostonians want to, you know, cut themselves to see some red or color.
It is kind of weird when you're up here because there is a distinct lack of color pretty much everywhere. There's a pretty, it is weird. It's pretty like just no color. It's kind of
Dennis Leary has a really good bit on it.
Oh, I love Dennis Leary. Good Bostonian. I do love Dennis Leary. So he ends up having it's just gross out. What's interesting is that his inauguration actually largely outlines what his presidency would be. It's kind of cool because it's 8,400 words.
Yeah.
It's a long time for a short presidency, so we kind of see what he wants to. First off, he's very big on he says directly in his speech, under no circumstance will I consent to serve a second term.
Interesting. Okay.
Which is kind of interesting there.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe the log cabin thing was true.
Yeah, right. So in the speech, he set out, he talked about the Whig Party, that he was the president, he was not going to be dictated to by the Whigs in Congress, but he also talked about kind of respecting the role of the presidency. Mm-hmm. And so from the start, you know, he signaled that he wasn't going to be managed by congressional Whigs. Like, you know, Henry Clay was important, but he was the president. He very famously exclaimed, I want to use that word carefully, exclaimed to Clay one day, he goes, "Mr. Clay, you forgot that I am the president." So he would get in it with Congress.
Right.
So he still had that general view. He still had that kind of little bit of Jackson that I think a lot of people liked. But it was funny because he did listen to the party.
Yeah.
He did. He would listen to Clay. He would listen to Webster.
So there's, I think Jackson went a little bit too far trying to say the executive branch was the most powerful of the branches, whereas it looks like Henry Harrison is more just trying to say, like, look, we're equal, co-equal branches of government here. You still need to have respect for me. Like, we work together, right? Kind of thing, maybe more like that?
And the Founding Fathers never intended for them to be equal branches. I think that's something. The Article 1 of the Constitution is the legislative branch, specifically because the legislative branch is directly elected by the people.
Right.
And the Founding Fathers thought that would be the most important. And then Jackson, I think everybody shifted away from it. Jackson specifically did it. But no, it was still I have the right to check and balance you. But this was less than something interesting. Kyle, I'm happy you brought this up because I was going to gloss over this, but this is kind of cool. This is not a constitutional thing with Harrison. This is a party thing with Harrison. I don't think Harrison has a thought negative on that differential.
Just more like he was the party leader.
Yes.
Because he's the president.
Because he's the president, which I think is fair. And he was always comfortable with the peer-to-peer, but he did not like the overstepping. And listen, I love Henry Clay. I think he's super interesting. Henry Clay overstepped all the time. That's probably why I like Henry Clay. Yeah. Like, he's Henry Clay. Like, come on, man. Like, guy was just in Congress or in the White House for like 90% of his career. Like,
I'm getting kind of tired of hearing his name, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and we're not done with Henry Clay. but yeah, so he did not like to be dictated to. He liked to collaborate, but he didn't want to be dictated to, which sounds like a general, right? That sounds like a general.
Yeah.
Like, I want to make the decision. Don't talk to make him a child. But I'm curious what my NCOs have to say. This actually ends up working, kind of. I hate to say it. Like, he was very busy in the 1 month he was in office. This ends up, like, working. Everybody kind of like, okay, he's a reasonable person. I can talk to him. He's very, very results-focused. I mean, if there's one thing that would define President Harrison's life, result-focused. Not that I have a direct quote for him, but reading through him, it's basically, like, the only thing that matters are the results. Like, You got the best of intentions. That's why I very much find – I don't think him and Jackson would have got along because I do think he's like, results matter. Your results are awful. Did nothing. would you like to go to Detroit, Michigan, comma, United States as opposed to Detroit, Michigan, comma, Britain?
Ontario.
Ontario. Detroit, Ontario. Where I was going to say our dear friend up in Alberta.
I know, right?
But I'm not from Ontario.
I did get a comment from him, by the way. He asked if we could do Canada next, but I wasn't sure what he's referring to. So, Joel, maybe you can explain that one for us. What more Joel, Canada do you want us to cover? Because we love doing that.
Up. If it means more, Joel, I'm always up for it. Albertan brother. But do you know what's funny? So he ends up... actually being wicked stressed and worn out for the presidency. So he has because at this point, the patronage systems is going on. So, like, especially because this is the first fully mobilized campaign. So there's even more patrons than normal. And there's kind of this open door policy where they can come visit him. And people just want to meet him. Again, he's a charismatic guy with a good reputation. Now he's president, right?
Now he's giving out free cider. I mean,
they're giving out free cider. And then He actually described this in a letter. It was in, I almost said journal, but it was in a letter where he found it. He didn't have even enough time to quote to attend to the necessary function of nature.
Oh,
so he's like, I didn't have time to go to the bathroom. I just love that. That's like somebody even say today. I didn't have time to go take a leak. Like, I love that. William Henry Harrison, I think, actually would poll pretty well today.
I think so.
Going back with Kyle's earlier comment from free, I'm actually, we just need to get him off the slavery thing. People very well.
Right.
On March 17th, so he gets right into it, issues his first formal proclamation. He summons Congress to a special session on May 31st to address the economy. A lot of people really liked this because it was like, he's being super proactive.
Yeah.
And that was basically, given that time in history, that was the earliest you could summon people back, given travel and all that stuff. The Whig Party basically had this plan for bank reform and finance reform once Congress convened. Now, he would not live to see that, obviously, but John Tyler actually did oversee that special session of Congress. So he did follow through on his predecessor.
Did Harrison leave good enough notes for John Tyler so he at least knew what he was going to be doing?
Dude, from everything I read, they were a pretty good dynamic
duo. Pretty good team, yeah.
Yeah, like, they liked each other. Don't forget, like, John Tyler was no military slouch either. And he's an interesting guy,
too. He was there,
too.
John
Tyler Jr.
He was there, too.
So they got along pretty well. I mean, John Tyler was, we'll cover it in the next. But I think a fairly effective administrator. I also don't know if he was ever like, I want to be president.
I know, right? Vice president, I don't know. Everyone thinks it's a stepping stone, but I'm not sure that it necessarily is. It almost is like the place where you can go where you can be like, I'm almost the president, but that's close enough.
At this point, it's Secretary of State. I think John Tyler was more like, hey, this guy I really respect, who I look up to, asked me to be the vice president. I agree with what they're trying to do. I agree with all this stuff. I'll serve with my general one more time.
Right.
And then his general died. I think he was probably devastated. I think it was like, like a father figure die.
Yeah.
The last week of March, Harrison, he falls ill. And if we look at official physician reports, after several days of indisposition, which is basically constipation, from what I understand, when I was looking at the...
not having time to use the bathroom?
Yeah, right. by March 27th, he's having fevers and chills. He starts to exhibit signs of pretty complex pneumonia. And they also report, and this is I'm directly quoting the reports of the time, congestion of the liver and derangement of the stomach and bowels. I read that as distinction, but
yeah, this sounds way too long after the inauguration to be related to that, doesn't it?
Yes. So Thomas Miller, who was his attending physician, He also brought in consulting physicians, and these guys are the big names of the time, so that's when we read that. Frederick Way, N.W. Worthington, J.C. Hall, and Ashton Alexander. I mean, these guys are...
You're going to say another name that just said last episode.
Was that John Doctor Armstrong.
Again? Yeah, there we go.
Benjamin Rush. Benjamin Rush has to be...
That one, Benjamin
Rush. Has to be at least 80. Has to be at least 105.
Benjamin Rush has to be in there, right?
Benjamin Rush has to be dead by this point. Dick Rush, Dick Johnson showed up. He didn't really have anything to do with this. But they try everything using like the standard treatment of the time. So there's bloodletting,
probably
blistering. You know, there's even topical blistering. Yeah, I don't really know what the blistering would be. And then they're just obviously like doing everything that we know doesn't work now.
Yeah, get a bird to peck on it and hope that some lemon juice will clear things up.
Yeah, right. So by this time, he develops profuse diarrhea. And he passes away April 3rd. He died at 12:30 a.m. Profuse diarrhea set in on, and that's usually what dehydrates you. Coffin. April 3rd. And then he dies actually 12:30 a.m. on April 4th. His last words, and this is according to the American Presidency Project, so I just want to call them out, so you know, cite them just for the record, just so they can, I know, I feel... bad, whatever. I feel like I know last words are like, that's obviously like public record. Everybody knows them, they made it like.
I thought it was going to be something crazy now that you've prefaced it so much.
No. It is a cool phrase. And okay. it's a very like, not what you'd expect somebody dying to say. That's why I want to be like, hey, good job, the American Presidency Project, for looking this up. Cool. He turned to Dr. Worthington and said, "Sir, I wish you to understand the true principles of government. I wish them carried out. I ask nothing more." And literally died almost immediately.
Actually, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very like... It honestly kind of fits Harrison a little bit for being this like consummate like public servant. Like his whole life's public servant. He wasn't a lawyer. Yeah. He didn't do anything of that. But he's a guy who was like, well, I was the diplomat to Grand Columbia. Well, that's over. I guess I'll go be a clerk at a court.
And then I'll just get promoted to president from
there. And then I'll become president. It's like, I like this guy.
I was a captain, and I went straight to general.
Yeah, that was also weird, too. Can we not? I feel like nobody talks about the fact he's like, you're a captain. A couple of years, being a pretty effective chief administrative officer. Would you like to be general? It's like, I feel like
if I was in charge of Martin Van Buren's campaign, I would have had, instead of picking at his legislative abilities, which was just not a good plan, I think I would have gone with the line cutter. Like, nobody likes a line cutter.
Yeah,
this guy keeps cutting the line. Like, you can't go from county clerk to president.
But then you could also just be like, well, he's effective when they promoted him. Like, he worked very well.
I know. He probably still loses.
Even going captain to the Secretary of the Northwest Territory is a wild promotion.
Right?
Like, that's like, what are you doing, dude? That's like going from being a captain in the National Guard to being the lieutenant governor. You're like, what? Right. Can't be qualified for this, dude. So this was the first time we ever saw the test of the Constitution presidential succession. Vice President John Tyler immediately asserts full presidential authority rather than an acting status, which I think was very smart. He was the president. That's how the Constitution is written.
You do not let that go. A power vacuum is the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah. So Congress met on May 31st, 1841, and he addressed them in a special session, almost like a State of the Union kind of.
Right.
And actually, today, that's still known as the Tyler precedent. That idea of when a president has to take over after a vice president takes over after presidential death, of immediately addressing Congress, talking to Congress immediately. And you're right, Kyle. It stopped that power vacuum, which.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of important to stop. All right. So, Kyle, I broke it down. I want to run as we close out this abbreviated episode because of this abbreviated president. I thought this would be fun. I have four, let's call them dominant explanations on what killed William Henry Harrison. I'm going to run you through each four. And I'm not going to tell you, like, which one's the consensus, which one's the theory, all that stuff, right? I got four. Again, I'm not putting them in
no order.
So let's start.
If you're playing along with us, I want to see the comments. Which one you think is the true one here? We'll call this three facts or three fictions and a fact.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so first suggestion: this is typhoid or paratyphoid. Yes, from contaminated White House water. Mm. So, in a 2014 analysis by Clinical Infectious Disease, it re-examined doctor notes. So all of these are re-examination of doctor notes. I'm just going to give you when the theories popped up. Remember, these are all re-examined of doctor notes. So they re-examined the doctor notes. And Washington Sanitation Systems in 1841. I mentioned last episode, there's a little bit of econ in here. This is around the same time that Jon Snow first started mapping out cholera exposures using the around the Broad Street pump. And it's how we get the first geospatial analysis.
Is he the one who also like went rogue and just put chlorine in the water systems?
I don't know if he did that, but that would make sense. I don't know if he was a good chemist to understand that enough, but he was the guy who was like, oh, these like septic tanks are broken and they're leaching into the river and we need to stop that because that's where your cholera breaks. it argues that Harrison's prominent gastrointestinal what happened, the course of the infection or the disease progression, I should say, really points to typhoid or likely typhoid caused by some sort of salmonella poisoning, and that would be acquired from the White House water supply, which is downstream from human waste dumps or night soil depositories.
Okay.
And that the pneumonia was secondary, and while it may have caused his death, the pneumonia was
a symptom of the typhoid.
Yes. The second one.
Typhoid, that seems like, I'm not buying the typhoid one. I would have thought like cholera or dysentery would be more like the symptoms that were described.
Yeah, I think of waste, but that's just because of like snow. It's called a snow analysis, by the way. There's actually even an analysis.
Oh, I was just thinking of Oregon Trail, playing that as a kid.
here's another one. Harrison, this one's based on Harrison speaking for 2 hours without a hat or overcoat on that cold, damp day. And then he stayed in the wet clothes for, the subsequent reception. He never changed out. And that he caught his death at the inauguration. And by caught his death, I mean he had, he developed some form of bacterial upper and then subsequently lower respiratory infection that then caused a fatal case of pneumonia. And that the gastrointestinal symptoms were merely, he was an older gentleman and the stress from the pulmonary distress just simply cascaded throughout his entire system, and that it was kind of like a system shutdown.
Okay.
And the diarrhea was just a symptom of that.
I thought you were just going to say he was old and couldn't control his bladder anymore.
Right. The other one is right lower lobe pneumonia, where he had a persistent infection that may have been present for a long time prior, and that the pneumonia that the doctors described is really, I hate to say this, but a simple, they describe it as a simple case of right lower lobe pneumonia that accounts for a lot of death in older people, where this persistent infection basically just fatigues out the body and becomes a fatal illness.
Is this what they call walking pneumonia?
Walking pneumonia is usually when you have pneumonia but you don't know it.
Right.
So it would be walking pneumonia that then progresses into this.
Into sleeping pneumonia.
Eventually, and he dies from that because, again, he's 68. It's in the 1840s. He lived a very rough life in terms of, he fought battles. He was in wars. He was did all this stuff.
The doctors weren't really doing many favors by, bloodletting and burning him.
Yep.
And or whatever the burn treatment was.
Blistering. Which is why. What a weird. And these things compounded poor medical treatment. It's a simple case of right lower lobe pneumonia that still accounts for a lot of deaths today in the world. And then the final one is a mix of likely typhoid fever, and a secondary bronchopneumonia infection that both came upon at the same time. We're basically saying that it was the reason we saw the gastrointestinal issues were caused by the typhoid. And the typhoid was present simultaneously to bronchial pneumonia, which if I'm reading this correctly, bronchial pneumonia is basically pneumonia that exists. Pneumonia is basically a bunch of microplastics
in
your lungs.
Where it is. Yes. So if it's in the bronchial tubes, then that's.
And he basically was the bronchial pneumonia fatigued him so greatly that his body could not fight off kind of a mild salmonella infection, I guess is what they would say. And it simply exhausted him. That's actually the term they use. And they cite that his pneumonia was both subdued and great measure. It wasn't pronounced pneumonia. But the bowels never recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And they cite in this one that he died in, this group, this is PubMed, an article on PubMed, and that they basically cited this and said, he died after he developed diarrhea on April 3rd. He died on April 4th.
Right.
Of diarrhea. They said it's weird to think we should look at the thing that when it presented, it killed him, as opposed to looking at everything else. So, Kyle, out of those four explanations, and I'll run through them again. First one.
I already have my answer.
All right. What is it?
Well, first of all, we're not going to say the answer until next episode. Encourage people to listen along, but I'll give my thoughts. I think you have the catch-all D at the last one there, which is the... I think that's a trick, though. I don't think that's... I don't think that really is the answer. I think it's actually number three. I think it's the simplest one. And that's going to be my answer, but if you want to know the actual truth, you're going to have to listen to next week's episode, I think, to hear that. But I do want your guesses in the comments. And if anybody actually nails it, what are we gonna give them?
I don't know. Well, we gotta get people remember to email us because I want to put this order of notebooks. And some John Abbs notebooks.
Yes.
I don't know. We'll think of something. We'll make some custom.
Maybe they could pick a bonus episode.
Yeah, they can pick a bonus episode. Mail them something goofy.
Pick us a pick us a topic.
Some merch.
Yeah,
I'm gonna order some merch.
Yeah, we gotta get this journal going.
Yeah,
all right, you ready to do some POTUS ranking for
Mr.
Harrison? Okay. I think we can take into account the fact that he didn't have a whole lot of time to get anything done, but I don't want to ding him too much on that. I want to try to do this seriously.
Yeah.
So we go through our POTUS ranking, as mentioned before: political influence, overall governance, transformational leadership, understanding of public needs, and strategic vision. Where do you want to start with? Start with P as usual. Impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts. Remember, this is supposed to be during the presidency, but we do allow a little bit of overlap.
Yeah, that was my trial. Yeah. Party dynamics, stuff like that. New party, but he did lose the first time running because we're going to have to put a lot of weight towards the beginning of his career. Oh, I'd like to give him – he understood party dynamics. He did it pretty well. Then if we look at – he did lose, but there's also a new party. Yeah. I'd give him a 6. I think I'd take a point away from his previous loss, but I mean, he understood party dynamics. He did a landslide against an incumbent president who was considered the protege to Jackson. I think six is very fair.
All right, I think go with that. All right, overall governance, the effectiveness of the president's administration implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governments. Yes, you can.
Yeah, we're doing zero. There's just he didn't do any of that.
I'm sorry.
Maybe he would have.
Yeah. If we could take his entire career, this would probably be a 7, honestly.
Right? I think he would have been a great president.
Transformational leadership, the president's capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. Yeah. They address pressing society. No, none of that.
Yeah, zero.
Zero again. Yeah. Understanding of public needs. How well did they understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the public?
When you were reading it, when you said the phrase, understanding public need, I was like, oh my god, that if it's just that one, he maxed out
right
that skill.
I think
branch.
He understood a lot of this. Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively? I think that is where
zero.
You have
to have time.
Exactly.
Let's give him a 1. Can we give him a 1, Kyle?
I want to give him a little more than that, actually.
Okay, I can do a 2.
2? All right. Strategic vision, clarity and ambition of his vision to carry the country. Do you have a forward-thinking approach? It inspired hope for the future.
He definitely inspired hope for the future. He had a forward-looking approach. We never got to hear what he was going to say on the May 31st Congress. But he clearly had a vision of what he
wanted
to do.
Based on the inauguration speech.
Based on the inauguration. So, I don't know how – I don't want to ding him. You kind of have to. I would say 3, right? I would say, he had a – but he was intentionally vague. If his platform was very detailed and we had this detailed detailed inauguration address, I'd be like, oh, maybe a 6. But I think because of the ambiguity dictated most of his presentation of his plan, because he obviously ran for president much longer than he was president. I'd say 3 is fair, because 3 is I'm giving you max points because you have this very detailed plan in your inauguration. But in terms of your execution of that, that's a different discussion.
Yeah. And again, this is not his fault either. Right. This is just, man, I'd really love to play the What If game with him one of these days.
I will draft up an episode for What If.
All right.
And send it over to you.
All right. So you want to do three?
Yeah.
I think that seems fair. All right. Unfortunately, this is going to put him on our Mount Slow list. But, I mean, unless you want to give him some more points on governance or leadership.
We did the most we could. I think we can. I think we're very fair with him.
I don't know that he can go on it, but can we give him like bonus points for something?
Yeah, let's give him, let's give him a host wave.
Right? Just a like pass.
The host agreed. He just gets passed. He gets.
We'll call this the Mount Slowless Pass.
Yeah, well, that's what we're doing. He doesn't deserve to be on there. I hope I made people like William Henry Harrison. That was kind of my goal, but like, I think people are going to be like, oh, he's kind of awesome.
William Henry Harrison is kind of my low-key like favorite kind of like what if moment. Like, I wonder how much he could have changed the history of this.
He was just so effective in every position he ever held. That's kind of like, oh, I wonder if he would have been an effective president. It's like, probably.
I wonder if we would have had a civil war still, if he could have been enough to you know, mend some of those fences.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been, it's hard to, the radicals, it was hard to convince them that even emancipation would have been.
Right.
Okay, but.
Right.
It is funny because the Emancipation Proclamation is more like, it was actually more abolitionist than anything else. Right. That doesn't run off the tongue well.
All right. Well, I think that is the end of part two. We do have another bonus episode, so we will be talking about Mr. Harrison a little bit longer next week. But while you're waiting for that, please comment or send us your thoughts on the guesses of what actually killed Mr. Harrison. We'll get to the answer to that next week. In the meantime, you can email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com. Visit the website. Actually, visit our other website, chinashopproductions.com, because there's a ton of other amazing content on there that'll keep you busy until we can see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.